Dying isn't easy, but once it's in sight, people begin to make plans. They want to resolve decisions before they go, to avoid squabbling among the bereaved. How unseemly, then, is the news that the family of Billy Graham is already quarrelling among themselves while their patriarch is still alive. 88 years old and ailing, Billy Graham is probably the most influential Christian leader in the world today. He has presented the gospel to more than 210 million people personally, face to face, or through his films and other programs, in 185 countries. And in a George Barna survey conducted recently, Billy Graham was the only religious leader in America today that the majority of Americans had positive views toward. The only Christian leader in America where the majority of Americans were favorable towards a Christian leader. The only one. Well, sadly, they won't be impressed with the behavior of his son, Franklin, because a controversy is developing between Franklin and Billy Graham's wife and his younger brother, Billy Graham's younger son, Ned. As one commentator put it, it is a struggle worthy of the Old Testament, pitting brother against brother, son against mother, and leaving the father, the Reverend Billy Graham, trapped in the middle, pondering what to do. What is all the fuss about? Well, it concerns a dispute over the final resting place of Billy and Ruth Graham. Ruth, Billy's wife, desires to be buried along with Billy Graham in the mountains of North Carolina, where she raised her five children and the home of the original Billy Graham Training Center. Franklin Graham, the eldest son and heir to the father's ministry, has a different idea. Franklin has designed a barn-shaped Billy Graham library, which is being built in Charlotte, North Carolina, where visitors will pass through a 40-foot high glass entry cut in the shape of a cross. They will be greeted by a mechanical talking cow. They will follow a path of straw through rooms full of multimedia exhibitions. And at the end of the tour, they will be pointed toward a stone walk, also in the shape of the cross, leading to a garden where the bodies of Billy and Ruth Graham will lie. Throughout the tour, they will be have several opportunities to put their names on a mailing list. Now, why in the world would Franklin want to do this? This is what he said in numerous newspaper articles subsequently. Quote, I wanted to show to another generation of pastors and evangelists what God did through a man who was faithful and who communicated it simply. What about the cow? Well, this is what Franklin says. One of my main concerns is how do you engage a child? His solution is to have a cow, which might say something like, hello, I bet you don't know milk comes from a cow. Well, most English kids don't seem to know that. Well, let me tell you about it, he says. The cow will introduce Billy. Billy was young. We cows knew there was something special about him. That's what Franklin has said. Quote. Reactions, well, Patricia Cornwell, who's a novelist and a good friend of Billy and Ruth Graham, said, I was horrified by what I saw. It's a mockery. And the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association board member Graham Keith said of the cow, it truly is tacky. Ned Graham, the son, fears it will belittle Billy's ministry. And Billy's wife, Ruth, responds, it's a circus, a tourist attraction. Well, I don't delight in sharing that with you, but it's mainline news in many Christian journals at the moment. And it pointedly illustrates the passage before us today. What went wrong? What lessons can we learn? How do we pass on our heritage to our children? How do we inculcate our values in such a way that they will embrace them for themselves? How do we as a church ensure continuity in succession when pastors move on? James will be leaving soon. We hope to appoint two new pastors, an associate and an executive pastor. How do we ensure continuity that we build on the foundation God is laying? Well, tonight we're beginning a new series of Bible studies exploring the life of Solomon entitled God's King in God's Kingdom. And we've entitled the first chapter, The True King, or How to Plan for Your Succession. Now, in this opening chapter, there are actually three kings. Israel was blessed with three kings simultaneously. There was David, the elderly king, suffering from hypothermia, and there were his two sons, Adonijah, the oldest surviving with great ambitions, and there was Solomon, David's son by Bathsheba, who seemed the very opposite of his half-brother. There's a host of other characters. There's Nathan, Joab, Bathsheba, and many more. The first chapter looks a little bit like one of those modern TV dramas, and it begins with a cliffhanger just to get you to watch the second episode. Well, that's next week, so do come back for more. But at another level, it is an intensely political event. We see here essentially a coup d'etat. But it goes much, much deeper than this, because it teaches us important lessons about parenting, about the way we bring up children, the way we treat elderly relatives, their possessions, the way we plan for succession in our workplace, in our society, and above all, in our church. Quite simply, in this last episode in David's life, we are shown the difference between God's way of doing things and the world's way. Well, let's briefly set the scene and look at what we are told. First of all, about David. David is the elderly king. This is chapter 1, verses 1 to 8. Now, I haven't got the verses coming up on the screen, so I want you to go back to the Bible and discover it there. The opening chapter of 1 Kings records the last days of David. Notice, first of all, David's physical condition, verse 1. He could not keep warm even when he was covered up. He was very old, suffering from hypothermia, and he was given special nursing treatment. Now, doctors have known for thousands of years that in the case of severe loss of body temperature, contact with body heat is the best form of treatment. Now, in Soviet Siberia, I understand this is normal medical practice. Now, I'm sure there's nothing wrong with Soviet nurses, but being a king, David was able to go private, and he got a pretty nurse as well. His physical condition, but the writer is very careful to make it clear that there was no sexual union between them. And then we find David's family concerns, verse 6. Verse 6, his father had never rebuked him by asking, "Why do you behave as you do?" In the case of Adonijah, it seems David had not been a good father. David had grieved bitterly over the death of Absalom, and it seems as if David had spoilt his next son, Adonijah. The text tells us Adonijah was handsome, and that may give us a clue. Parents sometimes have favorites, and often it has to do with looks. David became your typical distant father. He didn't have time to get involved in discipling and shaping Adonijah's character. He overlooked his behavior. He failed to discipline him. And today's story, a repetition almost of that of Absalom, is about how David reaped the consequence of pampering his elder son. His physical condition, family concerns, and then thirdly, David's political confidence, verses 7 and 8. David was losing not only physical strength, but political power. Key military leaders like Joab, religious leaders like Abiathar, were switching their allegiance in the ensuing succession. Notice this is happening in the Labour Party at the moment, with individuals switching sides before Tony Blair has actually resigned. Jumping ship, perhaps. David seems to have failed to communicate adequately to ensure a smooth transition of leadership. Now, it's very different to what we are seeing. It's not very different to what we see in many other countries today. Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, for example, he cannot cope with the rising aspirations of his people for political reform and democratic freedoms. In the process, he's lost all credibility by using the military and judicial system to escalate repression. He uses intimidations, beatings, and imprisonment as a way of holding on to power. For very different reasons, David not only contributed to the power struggle for the monarchy, he actually caused it. Now let's look at the first and eldest of his surviving sons, Adonijah, the prince regent. Adonijah must have read Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, because he had all the right qualities to get on in life. What was his first quality? Well, naked ambition, verse 5. He had ambition. Now, is there anything wrong in having ambition? to want to be a managing director, a prime minister, or an archbishop? Well, it depends on our motive. Is it for God's glory? Will it contribute to the extension of his kingdom? Will it enable me to serve others more effectively? This is where Adonijah and Solomon were so different. Not only was Adonijah ambitious, he was also incredibly arrogant. He doesn't say, "I want to become king." Verse 5, what does it say? "I will become king." This wasn't simply an exercise in the power of positive thinking. This is evidence that he believed. It wasn't even that he believed in the materialistic doctrine of name it and claim it. This wasn't a sign of faith, it was a sign of rebellion. Naked ambition, blind arrogance, but he was photogenic. He had physical attraction. Again, verse 6 tells us he was handsome, just the kind of quality needed in a successful leader. He had charisma. Adonijah, therefore, had all the right human qualities to make it to the top. Furthermore, he had the right qualifications. He was a natural successor. He was the elder surviving, and in many other situations, he would automatically have become the king. But alongside that, he was a rotten schemer. Three essential parts to his scheme. He began with the psychological warfare. He needed to polish up his image. He acquired the equivalent of Saatchi and Saatchi, and they got him 50 nice men in bright uniforms to run ahead of his chariots. He did his PR work. He didn't have one limousine, he had a fleet of them. Secondly, there is intrigue. He succeeded by winning not only the popular vote of the people, but the power brokers. And therefore we see him influencing and drawing to his side some of the key military, religious, and political leaders. Adonijah felt that General Joab and Bishop Abathar could tip the balance in his favor. And then influence. He went public. En-Rogel was a very public place just below to the south of the city of David. It's where the Kidron and the Hinnon valleys meet. And just the place to have a religious ceremony and a banquet for all the royal officials, his younger brothers, one or two notable exceptions. He probably blew a massive hole in his business expense account, but the investment was worth it. He had won both the psychological war and the political war. He was the natural successor and a rotten schemer. He was, in effect, crowning himself king, and everybody knew it. So Adonijah essentially epitomizes the secular, worldly strategy to get to the top. Now, how does he compare with Solomon? Well, Solomon is very different. First of all, we find in verses 29 and 30, he respected his father's wishes. He respected his father's wishes. Verse 29, "The king then took this oath, 'As surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of every trouble, I will surely carry out this very day what I swore to you by the Lord, the God of Israel. Solomon, your son, shall be king after me, and he will sit on my throne in my place.'" 1 Chronicles 28 tells us the Lord revealed to David that it was to be Solomon who would succeed him and build a temple. David had solemnly sworn to Bathsheba that this would happen. It's therefore not unreasonable that as he grew up, Solomon was made aware of these solemn promises made by his father David and to his mother Bathsheba. Now, it's important that we don't argue from silence. But in this first chapter, there is no hint that Solomon sought to claim his right to the throne. He's not recorded as taking any initiative, not even in reminding his father or hinting to him of the promise made years earlier. He respected his father's wishes. He relied on the wisdom of God. He relied on the wisdom of God. We get this from 1 Kings 3, verse 3. "Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream, and God said, 'Ask for whatever you want me to give you.'" Now, how would you respond to a blank check like that? Three ways Solomon relied on God's wisdom. Verse 6, By faith he recognized his testimony. You have shown me great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You've continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. He recognized his destiny. In humility, he recognized his need. Verse 7, "Now, O Lord my God, you've made your servant king in place of my father David, but I am only a little child, and I do not know how to carry out my duties." And that suggests that David hadn't prepared him and trained him for that task as well. But he recognized his need. And then in service, he recognized his responsibility. Verse 8, "Your servant is here among the people you've chosen, a great people too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours?" The Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. Adonai wanted to rule. I will become king. Solomon wanted to serve. I need God's help. And God richly blessed Solomon and made him a worthy successor to David. As we'll see in the weeks to come, Solomon built the temple and God's people prospered because he respected his father, trusted his supporters, and sought God's wisdom by faith, in humility, and in service. Now, while David might not have been a good father earlier in his life, he hadn't paid attention to his succession planning early enough, when he discovered that Adonijah was attempting to usurp his authority, David acted. What did David do right? Well, first of all, we see he made a public commitment. John Maxwell calls these the law of legacy. First of all, he made a public commitment. He made it known, calling Bathsheba, and through Bathsheba he gave this public oath. He then brought key influencers into the process. Verse 32, "Call in Zadok, Nathan the prophet, Benaniah, son of Jehoiada." He brought in key influencers. Thirdly, he gave Solomon some of his own resources, easily recognizable to the people. Verse 33, "Take your Lord's servant with you and have Solomon, my son, mount my own mule and take him down to Gihon." Somehow, David's mule was recognizable. He set up a public commissioning for Solomon, verses 34 and 35. He publicly endorsed Solomon's leadership, verse 35, and he initiated a celebration for the transition. Public celebration, a loud celebration, a visible celebration. The horn of oil from the sacred tent. They sounded the trumpet, and all the people shouted, "Long live King Solomon." Now, this is how David, with God's help, ensured a godly succession to the throne. Now, it may be too late for Billy Graham, but it is not too late for you. How can you ensure a godly succession in your home, in your family, in your work? How do we ensure a godly succession in our church? Well, let's just briefly look at this as we wrap it up. The necessity of purpose-driven leadership. Seven lessons in leadership. The first is that success without a successor is a failure. Success without a successor is a failure. This is what Elizabeth Elliot says in a book she wrote on marriage and family. She said, quote, "It is sad to read that the average father nowadays spends 3 minutes per week with each child. Home, frankly, is just not his scene. He'd rather be elsewhere. What does he do with the rest of his time? Is it a relentless, frantic scramble to earn money 5 or 6 days a week, with a frantic scramble on weekends to relax and enjoy himself, often in expensive and sometimes dangerous ways? Can this really be what God wants for Christians?" From a very early age, having read a few books like that, decided I would spend Saturday mornings with my children in rotation. And I still take Michael out for breakfast on a Saturday morning. The other ones have grown up, but they all look back to those times we spent together on a Saturday morning just talking about whatever they wanted to talk about. And I still look forward to my Saturday mornings. Secondly, decision-making and problem-solving are the fastest way to gain influence. We must be proactive as leaders and solve problems. Thirdly, we need to check our motives before trying to lead anything. Am I building a man-made empire or am I serving the kingdom of God? Fourthly, don't prioritize your schedule, schedule your priorities. Don't prioritize your schedule, schedule your priorities. Fifthly, influencing followers is addition. Influencing leaders is multiplication. We have a limited amount of time. Are we prioritizing our time in order that we are reproducing ourselves? Six, keep first things first. Distraction is the enemy of direction. So easy to get distracted from our priorities. And then finally, leaders must touch the heart before they ask for a hand. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Seven lessons in leadership that we learn from David and Solomon. We may be very good at reproducing ourselves physically, but what about spiritually? David, the elderly king, Adonijah, the prince regent, Solomon, the anointed king. David, succession plan. That was David's succession plan, a little late, but God blessed it and ensured that Solomon succeeded David as king, as we shall see next week. But what about you and I? What are we going to do differently this week in the light of this passage? Well, here's your homework. 2 Timothy 2:2. If you haven't memorized this, I commend it to you as an excellent verse to burn into your brain as your assignment in planning your succession. The things you have heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to reliable people who will also be qualified to teach others. There are four generations there. Paul, Timothy, the reliable people who will teach others. That, I suggest, is multiplication in ministry, the way to ensure for our succession. In your outline, you've got some homework, and you may like to look at it now, or you may like just to close your eyes, and as we close in prayer, allow me just to read these questions to you and invite you to answer them in the week to come. Can you identify those you have a responsibility to lead or influence? Who has God entrusted to you? Your children, your grandchildren, a home group, employees. What are your core values and principles? How are you communicating these to the people that matter the most to you? What talents and skills have you developed? How are you passing these on in such a way that others can replicate them? What is your vision of the future? What is your passion? How are you sharing that vision, that passion, so that it becomes true for others? Like David, what changes in your life must you make in order to ensure a godly succession in your home, in our church, and in your work? If you make those changes, you may not have an artist paint your succession, but you can be sure that God will bless it. Let's pray together.